I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Now, Health Matters, presented by SSM Health. Here's your host, KMOX Health Editor, Fred Bottomer.
Hi there, and thanks a lot for joining me again. I really appreciate it. Hope you're having a great weekend. Lots to talk about coming up, including the latest on COVID-19 risk for those who vape and smoke cigarettes. SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital's brand new hospital is getting ready to open. We'll find out about that. And we'll hear about National Minority Donor Awareness Month. But first, let's get started the way we always do with our co-host, Dr. Fred Buchhold. Dr. Buchhold is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchhold, thanks a lot for joining us.
Always my pleasure.
So, Dr. Buchhold, give us an update. How are things looking locally when it comes to new COVID-19 cases?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's just we continue to have kind of a steady stream of new cases daily. It hasn't changed. There's still a good number. I think the last I look up, if I'm remembering correctly, it's about 500 a day of new cases in the region. So, it certainly hasn't grown, but we certainly are still getting the same amount of cases. And hospitalizations the same way. It's been more or less steady. We still have, roughly 10% of our hospital, maybe even a little bit higher than that, is people with COVID or people who are, we still call them PUIs, persons under investigation, which means we just have a test pending. We're waiting on the result.
This past week, there was lots of talk about something called oleandrin, a possible COVID-19 treatment. President Trump was asked about it earlier in the week.
Oleandrin? Have you heard of that as a possible therapy for coronavirus?
I've heard of it, yes. Go ahead.
Press the FDA to
No, I haven't.
It?
I haven't.
Is it something you would support?
Is it something that people are talking about very strongly? We'll look at it. We'll look at it. We're looking at a lot of different things. I will say the FDA has been great. They are very close. We're very close to a vaccine, very close to a therapeutic. I've heard that name mentioned. We'll find out. I can get back to you later.
Dr. Buchhold, what is oleandrin, and where do you come down on this?
Well, so from what I understand, and I've had to learn about it too, it's an extract from the oleander plant. It's similar to a drug that we've been using for a long time called digoxin. So digoxin was kind of classically used for people with what we call heart failure. It's sometimes used in other kind of conditions we call arrhythmias or abnormal heartbeats, less frequently now than we use in the past. So it's an old drug, and it has some relation chemically to what is extracted from oleander. So I really don't understand or see how it can be used for treating COVID. There's some thought it may affect immune response in some way, but there's no data to support that at all. And again, it's one of those things of, with a lot of extracts is, you know, there's purported health benefits and it's, you know, quote unquote natural that, you know, because it's natural, it must be good for you. And that just is a patently false assertion across the board. It may have some benefits. It also acts similar to this drug digoxin, and digoxin at toxic levels kills you. It causes an arrhythmia that is, if you don't get a electric shock, you die. So, you know, all of these have unclear side effects and benefits that, you know, requires good science to kind of tease out. And in no way have we done any of that work yet. So, and if we did, it still would take some time to kind of really fully understand that. So, it's not something I would recommend right now. In fact, caution against it strongly.
The FDA has put on hold the emergency authorization of convalescent blood plasma as a COVID-19 treatment. Why is that? And didn't you say earlier you were having good results using it in patients?
Well, yeah, I was using it, and they were getting better. I was also using steroids and remdesivir, too. So, you know, again, it's kind of two principles we talk in medicine all the time. And I absolutely understand to the lay person, you know, anybody listening about how medical science is funny. We say we do one thing and then do another. So, you know, let's say every morning I get up before dawn, make a cup of coffee, and then the sun rises. You know, by that logic, I say that by me making a cup of coffee, I'm making the sun rise. And because I'm putting the causation between two events that are clearly unrelated. And in medicine, the same thing occurs all the time. We do things and say, we think this might work. We think this might be helpful. We're going to continue to do it. But on the back end of that is saying, we have to do a good set of science to say, in reality, control for all other variables and just make the only difference with a person, a human being, is do we give them drug X or do we give them, you know, more often than not a placebo and see if there's a difference. So with the trial of remdesivir, we did exactly that. We compared remdesivir. We gave some people remdesivir. We gave other people placebo. The people giving the medicine and the people getting the medicine had no idea which one they got. We blinded them, is the kind of common word we use. And then after we get all the data, we have another person analyze that data and tell us the result. And in that, with remdesivir, we saw that it reduced hospitalizations. With the steroid dexamethasone, this was done in the United Kingdom, same thing. They gave some people dexamethasone. They gave others placebo. They watched it for, they did this for an amount of time. The patients and the doctors didn't know, each didn't know who got placebo versus who got steroids. And then you analyze results. And we saw with that, it reduced mortality. We have not done that work yet with plasma. The research that, you know, I helped with is saying that that was just looking to see if plasma is safe, giving convalescent plasma safe. It seems that that's the case, but there's no clear evidence of benefit. And so those studies are ongoing, but at the same time, we don't know whether we're harming or helping people. And so that's why the FDA kind of rescinded their emergency declaration of this. There's still, you know, I still think you could get it in certain situations, if you can kind of explain why. And again, studies are ongoing to see if this has a benefit. So, but we've got to do the science because, like we found out with hydroxychloroquine, and the world is full of things that have lots of great ideas and have some good science and thinking behind it. And then you do the evidence, you do the tests, and they don't show an effect. And impact may harm people. And that's, again, our first mantra is first do no harm. And that's so sacrosanct to what I do as a physician and our principles about how we go about taking care of people.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Buchholz. Dr. Buchholz is a slew care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Buchholz, a new poll this past week shows 56% of Americans say they would get a COVID-19 vaccine when one is ready. Will that be enough people to reach herd immunity?
Well, the number being bandied about is about the thought that 60%. So it's close. I'm glad it's at least close. I certainly would like to see the number be higher, clearly. And you never know how that might change, too, once a vaccine's out and once people start getting it and, you know, hopefully it's perceived as safe or hopefully it continues to show safety as we kind of give it to a larger number of people. And that builds confidence in the vaccine. Same thing, you know, again, we've talked before, and I'm sure we'll talk again about the flu vaccine and the perception that it makes you sick, which it really doesn't. But, you know, we have less of an argument about people getting the measles, mumps, or polio vaccine because it's been around for almost 50 years and people are comfortable getting it. So, you know, that unfortunately takes some time. And I understand it. But, you know, again, we need to get that number above 60 as quick as possible.
Moderna's COVID-19 vaccine candidate reportedly is having trouble getting enough minority volunteers in its phase 3 clinical trial. How important is minority participation in vaccine trials?
It's incredibly important. You know, again, COVID, as with many health conditions, I think disproportionately affects, I shouldn't say I think, I know it disproportionately affects the Black and Latinx communities in a greater degree than the white community in terms of infection rates and complications and mortality with this. And so when we're looking for a potential cure that, you know, is going to be effective for all our diverse population, you want to make sure you have a diverse group that you're studying to add to validity of those findings. It's, you know, as you know, SLU is participating in this. We really had a strong emphasis of reaching out to the Black community, particularly to help with getting them enrolled in the trial, and we really want that. But at the same token, you know, there is a large distrust of the medical community, particularly with the Black community, and it's frankly well deserved in the sense of a lot of history behind the medical community doing basically unethical research. The classic story is in Tuskegee in the 50s is a number of people were given purposely given syphilis to see how they did, so to speak, which is just, you know, completely unethical and never be done today. But you can just see how that kind of leads to a distrust and you know, we have to kind of deal with that, navigate that. But long story short, it's incredibly important. And, you know, particularly if anybody's listening that is a member of that community, really encourage you to enroll in any vaccine study, including the one that we're doing at SLU, which is a Moderna vaccine.
The state of Massachusetts will now require mandatory flu shots for all students before they come back to class. Think that's a good idea or bad?
No, I think it is. And I again, it goes back to this point of we have older vaccines, you know, polio, tetanus, measles, mumps, and rubella that almost every child gets unless you opt out. But, you know, you need to have proof of those vaccines before you can go to school. And when there are exceptions, and there are some medical exceptions that some people will get, if there's enough people in a school that don't have these vaccinations, outbreaks occur of diseases that, you know, generally don't occur in Western countries anymore, like polio. So long story short, I think, we have a means to prevent the spread of infection that can have, you know, with kids with flu, there's years with certain strains of flus where it's a little bit more deadly than usual, but still that death is a rare event. But kids can get incredibly sick and they can miss up to a week of school, and influenza spreads fast once it's there. And so, I'm a big supporter of that and of that policy. And I think we should be, you know, more aggressive in adopting that.
Anything else you want to add, Dr. Buchholz?
Yeah, just going back to influenza and kind of we've already started to have this discussion amongst, you know, my residents and my colleagues is, you know, we're kind of holding steady, you know, with dealing with COVID and it's certainly, it's still a strain, but it's something we're handling, you know, but in the flu season, once that hits, which is typically late October or November, the amount of patients we get goes up substantially, that we take care of in the hospital. So we're already kind of at that capacity right now. And so you add influenza into that, you know, it's not going to take much to kind of tip things over the edge. And I think that's continues to be a concern across the region, across the country, that a lot of healthcare providers have is there's still a lot of trepidation about the fall going into winter that, you know, we can kind of be in a world of hurt again. And that's, you know, I think it's something we just all as a community need to be aware of. Get your flu shot, please.
Dr. Buchholz, thanks a lot for your time again. Really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you, Fred. Appreciate it.
Dr. Fred Buchholz is a SLU care general internist at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up on Health Matters, we'll find out about the COVID risk for those who vape and smoke cigarettes. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. A new study finds teen vapers are up to 7 times more likely to get COVID-19 than non-e-cig users. To find out more about that, let's turn to Dr. Mohsen Essan. Dr. Essan is a pulmonologist at SSM Health St. Joseph Hospital in St. Charles. Dr. Essan, good to talk to you again.
Good to be here, Fred.
So tell us about this new study. What did it find?
So the study was done by researchers at the Stanford University School of Medicine and was published recently, and it looked at the connection between youth vaping and COVID-19 using U.S. population-based data. The study concluded that youth who vaped were 5 to 7 times likely to be infected with coronavirus. The study also found that people who had smoked cigarettes and e-cigarettes were 5 times likely to have usual COVID symptoms of cough, fever, tiredness, and difficulty in breathing.
So tell us about the science behind this. How does vaping and COVID-19 negatively impact lung function?
We know from the data that is coming out of COVID-19 that smoking is associated with higher likelihood of COVID-19 disease progression, severity of illness, ICU admission, and death. So it is definitely one of the risk factors. Now, we know that smoking damages your upper airway. It damages the lining of the lung and negatively affects the lung immune function. So the upper airway is the first line of defense against any inhaled agent. So coronavirus infects the upper airways initially, so you are more susceptible or prone to developing an infection for that reason. We know that smoking and vaping causes inflammation of the lung, which is augmented by coronavirus, resulting in more serious symptoms and possibly more severe disease.
Another study talked about how vaping and smoking increase the risk of transmission of COVID-19. Tell me about that.
Well, I think that is primarily because vaping, teens usually do it in groups and they might be sharing their devices. So that would probably be why they're probably transmitting the disease. At the same time, they're more at risk of contracting the disease because they are probably not wearing masks or maintaining social distancing. Since it makes you prone to develop symptoms, you are more likely to be tested. So the probability of having tested because you're having symptoms compared to somebody who is not smoking or vaping and maybe asymptomatic, that would, I guess, probably be responsible for higher incidence.
I imagine people who vape also touch their face more, and that's something we're not supposed to do as well.
Yeah, that's the most efficient way of transmitting the virus. So when you're touching things and at the same time touching your face, you're possibly transmitting the virus or infecting yourself.
And vapors also exhale a lot of air particles as well. So there's a lot of chance of spread there, too.
Exactly. That's true. So if you are in close proximity with other people and you are exhaling, there's a good chance that you might be transmitting the virus.
We're talking with Dr. Mohsen Essan. Dr. Essan is a pulmonologist with the SSM Health Medical Group. He's at SSM Health St. Joseph Hospital in St. Charles. Dr. Essan, how can people, especially those who vape, protect themselves and lower their risk of contracting the virus?
I would suggest in the midst of this pandemic, we certainly want to reduce our risk of not only contracting the virus, but also minimizing the severity of illness if people do get infected. So I would recommend quitting vaping. Other common sense measures, which is basically aimed at interrupting the transmission, like wearing masks, social distancing, washing your hands frequently, and avoid gatherings, are common sense measures that helps reducing the transmission or getting the virus itself. We know that community where mandatory restrictions are in place have done well. So another thing to point out is generally younger people think that they will do better if they get the virus, but we know that they can be very efficient spreaders of the virus. So they need to think about the loved ones or the friends who might be vulnerable and have pre-existing condition resulting in more severe disease. So my takeaway point from this would be to practice social distancing, avoid large crowds, wearing masks. Those will be the things that I would probably recommend, and quitting smoking or vaping, that would reduce your risk of developing severe disease.
Dr. Essan, about 6 months ago, before we even knew about COVID-19, there was a lot of focus in the medical community about e-cigarettes. What do you think has happened to that attention today, 6 months later. Is there still that concern about vaping out there?
I think the concern is there, and it is going to stay there, but the attention is kind of more focused on COVID-19 currently. So it has gone to the background, but the concern is not gone. And I'm sure with the media attention it got when it was more prevalent and we were seeing lots of cases, everybody knows about it. It certainly has probably impacted. We don't have the data, but I'm pretty sure it has reduced the number of people who are vaping, or people probably think about it more before they start vaping or do vape.
Dr. Aslan, one more time, tell me about the medical relationship between vaping and coronavirus. What do we know?
So COVID-19 affects upper airway and your lungs, and we know that vaping and smoking alter or reduce our body's defenses against coronavirus, resulting in to make us more vulnerable to infection. And then people who vape or smoke are more likely to develop more severe infection from COVID-19. The other thing that in terms of people who are more likely to get COVID-19 who vape is probably more related to the fact that they would have more symptoms. So they would more likely to be tested for COVID-19. And at the same time, maybe they are more exposed in terms of contracting the virus by being around more people, or especially in terms of teens or younger adults not maintaining social distancing or avoiding crowds and other such things.
So, Dr. Aslan, then your advice to young people especially, or those who smoke, is what?
So my advice to them would be to quit smoking and vaping, because it reduces the risk of not only getting the virus, but at the same time reduces the risk of getting severe disease from COVID-19. It also would help reducing the transmission to your friends and loved ones who might be more vulnerable.
Dr. Aslan, thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Dr. Mohsen Aslan is a pulmonologist with SSM Health St. Joseph Hospital in St. Charles. Coming up on Health Matters, did you know about half of the people on the transplant wait list are minorities? This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. There's a big effort to increase the number of minority organ and tissue donors this month. August is National Minority Donor Awareness Month. Here to talk with us about that is Dr. Henry Randall. Dr. Randall is the Transplant Surgical Director at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Randall, good to talk to you again.
Great to talk to you, too. Thank you.
Dr. Randall, what do you want us to know about National Minority Donor Awareness Month?
Sure. So there are a couple things about it. First of all, I'd like to highlight that it was first developed in 1996 out of an initiative called MOTEP. And Dr. Clive Callender from Howard University is the guy who came up with the concept of MOTEP. And it was brought about, just as you stated, to increase awareness of eye and tissue and organ donation, and to encourage families to register as organ donors. Finally, though, the other thing that seems a bit counterintuitive is that it does promote healthy living and encourages people to live wisely and healthy, so that they don't suffer the ravages of end-stage organ disease and need a transplant.
Are African Americans at greater risk for organ failure?
Statistically, yes. You know, just like other communities around the globe and in the United States, we have a high incidence and prevalence of things like hypertension and diabetes. Some of that is diet related, some related to lifestyle. So we actually occupy a significant population on the donor waiting list also for organs, especially kidneys.
Is the wait longer in general for minorities?
It can be. It depends on where you live. The more dense the population, meaning that the more people live in an area. Say, for instance, in California and New York or Florida, the wait times can be a little longer. It also depends on how available organs are. So the more people donating in a particular area, which is what we're highlighting and focusing on here, the more rapid people can expect to receive an organ. But in general, you can expect to wait somewhere in the 3 to 5 year time frame to receive, especially a kidney.
Is there any advantage to getting an organ from someone that shares your ethnic background?
Not in particular. I think there are still some studies looking at whether or not there's some benefit to that. To date, no one's really demonstrated that. What we're focusing on, though, is just increasing donation from the minority community, because what it does is it increases the rate of donation in general. And since African Americans occupy about a 40% position on the wait list, then you would expect that the more donors there are in general, the more African Americans or Hispanics or Asians, the more would receive organs.
We're talking with Dr. Henry Randall. Dr. Randall is the transplant surgical director at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Dr. Randall, what's the most needed organ?
Kidneys by far. If you look at the wait list, they're typically in this country on the order of about 75 to as many as 80,000 folks waiting for a kidney every year. So kidney by far is the most in demand organ or in need organ, and the organ that we transplant the most.
What other organs can be donated?
So if you look at a young, healthy donor, you can expect to get two lungs, a heart, a liver, a pancreas, and two kidneys. Also, now those are organs. If you look at tissue, you can use eyes for corneal transplants. I can tell you that my mother happened to benefit from that. She got a corneal transplant 2 years ago. And you can use skin, bone, and other tissue for transplant or for use in medical as medical need requires.
Dr. Randall, there are two types of organ donations, one from a living donor and the other from a cadaver donor. What's the difference and what are the advantages?
So, first of all, the difference is a cadaver donor is someone who has suffered a significant brain injury and they're considered brain dead, but their organs can remain viable as a patient is on a ventilator. So that's a cadaver donor. A living donor is just as stated. It's someone who's alive, and we can use organs from those people. In particular, we can use one kidney. And in the case of living donor liver transplants, we can actually take a portion of a person's liver and use that for a transplant. Now, the benefit is typically, a living donor has some sort of relationship with a recipient, so there's a strength of bonding or in bonding between those people. From a physiologic point or standpoint, a living donor offers the benefit of us working up a very healthy donor making sure that they have no medical problems that would preclude them from donating an organ. It won't shorten their life expectancy whatsoever. A short, what we call cold ischemic time, or the amount of time an organ sits on ice in preservation solution, that time is really short in living donors. So, for instance, when we perform living donors at SSM Health SLU Hospital, the donor is done in one room and the recipient is done in the next room. So there's only about a 35 to 40 minute time frame from removing an organ, flushing all the blood out, and then putting it in the recipient and having blood, blood flow restored. Those organs for kidneys start making urine right away. Folks get out of the hospital a lot quicker. So there's, and from a expectancy standpoint, those kidneys tend to last somewhere around the 15 to 20 year mark. So huge benefit for people receiving a living donor.
Has the pandemic had any impact on organ donation?
It did in the beginning, like back in February and March, when testing was sparse and we didn't have reliable tests or testing. A lot of us around the country put a hold on some transplants until testing became more reliable. And now that we have reliable testing since March, we've been back up and running at full speed. So it did have somewhat of a negative impact.
Dr. Randall, thanks a lot for your time. Get your message out one more time. What do you want people to know?
So we want people to know to, first of all, live a healthy lifestyle so that you don't yourself need a transplant. Number two, make your wishes known to your family that in the unfortunate event that you succumb to a major injury, that you would want your organs donated so that other people could benefit. Be a living donor if you can, transplant saves lives. So we encourage donation, across the board.
Dr. Randall, thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you.
Dr. Henry Randall is the Transplant Surgical Director at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Coming up on Health Matters, we'll find out about the brand new SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital about to open its doors. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You're listening to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
Now, back to Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. You've probably seen the billboards throughout the area. The grand new SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital will open its doors on September 1st. Here to talk with us about that is Kelly Baumer. Kelly is the Vice President of Clinical Services at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. Kelly, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So tell us about this new hospital. What do we expect to see?
Well, I think what you'll expect to see is just a beautiful environment that is very patient-centric so that we can provide exceptional health care to our patients. So you will see a lot of new technology. You'll see a beautiful space, a lot of green space, a lot of natural light in the facility, and really just advanced opportunities for higher levels of care. We have an enhanced emergency department, which will offer, we take care of level one trauma, so it will offer, really nice opportunities to provide that care. It also has many advancements in our interventional platform, which is where all of our surgical services and procedural care takes place. So, and then a beautiful environment for our patients to heal in our patient rooms, which offer, again, a lot of natural light and also just a really beautiful area for them and their family members to be in for healing.
Let's talk about the emergency department. How is that going to look?
So the emergency department, it is pretty much triple the size of our current emergency department, so a much larger platform. And we do have five level one trauma bays in the emergency department. We have many other rooms in the emergency department to take care of anyone's health care needs as they come to us for emergent care. We also have a dedicated CT scanner in our emergency department, which allows patients to come right in the doors and be taken to a CT scanner if that is appropriate for their care at that point. And also, it's just a very nice environment for our EMS colleagues to bring patients to, very easy for them. We've consulted with them throughout this process, so it will be a very easy place for them to bring patients.
I guess there are two distinct things that people notice the most about a hospital. One would be the emergency room. The other would be the patient rooms. Tell us a little bit more about the patient rooms.
Yes, we have all private patient rooms, and we have three what we call zones in our rooms. One of the zones is for our caregivers. Obviously, we have the patient zone, and then we have a family zone. And in that family zone area, we do have a couch that would turn into a bed if any family member would need to spend the night in that room with their loved one.
And you mentioned some of the common spaces and the open feeling and healing gardens. Tell us about all of those.
Right. So again, everywhere in the facility that we could put in natural light, so we have a lot of floor-to-ceiling windows, whether that be in the patient room areas, in our waiting spaces, but also we have a beautiful healing garden on the lower level of the facility. So it's a great area where people can really be with nature, and if patients are well enough, we can actually take them out to this garden as well as be available for staff and visitors to the campus.
Will the new hospital have more outpatient services?
Our new hospital will have an expanded outpatient platform, so we will offer the same types of services, but we have more procedure rooms, we have additional CT scanners, MRI equipment, so we will have a larger platform to provide our outpatient services in.
What about telemedicine services?
So we do have in our critical care rooms, we will have the ability for our physicians to look in on the patient. So if a nurse has a question about a patient, the physician can look into the room and check on that patient if they're not immediately in that area.
How much parking will the new facility have?
We have a brand new parking garage that has just a little under 1,000 spaces that'll be for all of our patients and visitors. And then we'll be utilizing other parking on the campus for our staff and physicians.
We're talking with Kelly Baumer. Kelly is the VP of Clinical Services with SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital about the grand new St. Louis University Hospital opening its doors on September 1st. Kelly, what's it like trying to open a hospital during a pandemic?
Well, opening a hospital during a pandemic just makes you look at some things, especially as it relates to training, and we've had to do training a little bit differently. So our initial training, which was going to be in large classroom styles, we actually did that more virtually. And then when we do need to take our staff over to orient them to the new facility, we've had to do many much smaller groups. So we had to limit it to 10 or under in every group as we were doing tours or really orienting our staff to their new spaces. So we had to think about that. The other things that we're having to look at as we open the hospital would be areas that we might need to use plexiglass. So we are looking at that. And then also making sure that any areas where we have waiting spaces, that those are appropriately distanced and following all of those guidelines that we need to follow for COVID.
Kelly, what's going to be the fate of the iconic Deloge Tower?
So the Deloge Tower, we are still looking at what will be repurposed for. Those plans are still under development.
Kelly, thanks a lot. Anything else you want us to know?
Just that we are very excited to be able to open this new facility. We are really a regional resource, and we're very excited for our community to be able to come in and experience our new facility.
Kelly, thanks a lot for your time. Really appreciate it.
Okay, thank you, Fred. Take care.
Kelly Baumer is the VP of Clinical Services at SSM Health St. Louis University Hospital. The new hospital will open its doors on September 1st. And that's all the time we have for this week's show. Thanks so much for listening. I really do appreciate it. If there are parts of this show you want to hear again, please log on to KMOX.com and look under the podcast section. Or you can download the radio.com app and favorite KMOX. This is KMOX Health Editor Fred Bottomer. Please join us again next week at the same time for another edition of Health Matters, presented by SSM Health on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.